A surprising number of people in the ancient world and right up into the classic world find that one of the best ways to clean your teeth and to brighten them is to swoosh them around with pee.
Welcome to Everyday Abundance, the podcast that explores the hidden histories behind everyday activities and technologies you didn't even know were technologies. Hi, I'm Virginia Postrell.
I'm Charles C. Mann. In this episode, we're going to talk about what some people call brushing your teeth, but I call the 15,000-year-old war between the Neolithic Revolution and your mouth. Today, most people get up in the morning and they brush their teeth. And this is one of those things where it's almost impossible for modern people to understand what a huge change this is. Not just the fact that billions of people are brushing their teeth every day, but that billions of people have teeth to brush to begin with. Famously, George Washington, you know, a wealthy plantation owner, when he was sworn in as president at the age of 57, had one tooth in his head.
And that's why we always hear about, like, George Washington wouldn't smile because he had wooden teeth. And that's
right. Right. It turns out this is a lie, a despicable lie.
Okay.
That he didn't have wooden teeth. Instead, he had false teeth made from real teeth from other people. And it's, you know, there's been like elaborate investigations by, you know, muckraking types. And it's unclear, but it's possible that some of those came from his own slaves.
After they were dead, I hope.
One assumes. At that time, there's this lively market in cadavers' teeth for just this purpose. And in fact, after the Battle of Waterloo, one of the things that people noticed is within hours, all those dead people on the field were being looted of their teeth. So many of the British soldiers buried at Waterloo were toothless by the time that the whole thing had happened.
It kind of doesn't make sense to me because you need your teeth to chew food, to bite it and to chew it. And it seems like this losing all your teeth would not be evolutionarily advantageous. It would get selected out. What happened? Did evolution screw up?
Right. Evolution, you know, you idiot, right? So turns out that the problem is agriculture.
Okay, so that comes long after.
Long after this. And in fact, you know, before agriculture, people didn't have cavities in the way that when I was eight and decided for some reason that brushing my teeth was stupid and ended up with a mouth of cavities, right? That just didn't happen as much. Now, people got food stuck in their teeth. And so there's lots of evidence of people kind of sawing away at their teeth. And if you look at very old teeth, you find these little grooves in them where it's pretty clear wooden or bone implements are like digging away at stuff. But they didn't really have to brush their teeth because they had dental disease in the same way, though, of course, some people did. Then comes agriculture. And what happens with agriculture is people start eating grains, starches, and these soft carbohydrates, and I'm talking about things like rice and millet and wheat and, you know, corn and all the things that, you know, you think of
with cereals.
Cereals, yeah. When you're chewing them up, your saliva in your mouth begins breaking them down as part of the digestive process and turning them into sugars, and bacteria in your mouth, that's breakfast for them. You know, so your mouth has suddenly become this locus of food, and they multiply like mad, and they form these biofilms, as they call it, which is otherwise known as dental plaque. And the byproducts of dental plaque is this acidic stuff that goes right through your enamel and causes all the misery. So with agriculture, suddenly comes this need to do something about dental plaque. And it happens right away. Early agricultural society that we have the best records of is all the ones in the Middle East with these cuneiform tablets. There was actually a guy, I'm going to have to take this because the name I cannot commit to memory, Ashurbanipal,
okay,
who was a king. He was a Neo-Assyrian king in about 650 BC. And what he decides to do, he's the first guy to say, I'm going to create a universal library of everything I know. You know, he's the early ancestor of the Internet Archive. He creates, you know, under his, you know, with a fleet of scribes, this the Neva Medical Encyclopedia. And it's full of stuff about how to clean and whiten your teeth with all kinds of weird ideas. So you mix together this special salt and a type of carrot and turpentine, and you rub it on your teeth. It's just really gassy. Another thing they do is natron, which is this mix of sodium bicarbonate and soda ash that you sometimes find naturally at the bottom of dry rivers, and probably kind of works. It's up to each way at the enamel. But they also have a theory, the world's first theory of tooth decay.
Okay.
And what to do about it. And so the theory is that tooth decay is caused by this special supernatural cosmic worm that is hungry. And for some reason, other gods decide it should eat your teeth. And so the way to treat it is with these various compounds, but also with magical invocations. And I'm going to read to you one. Indeed, the worm is the one that became hostile via the door of the flesh, via the bar of the bone. Whom shall I send to the firstborn son of the mountains, Marduk, that the worm be smashed? May the worm get out through the doorpost socket like a mongoose. So you say this and you clean your teeth, and that's how you did things in the Assyrian days. I'm going to take a wild guess and say this was probably not all that effective. Well, Virginia, you look skeptical.
Well, you know what? We could say, well, the bacteria is kind of like the worm. I'm on edge.
This is you defending the wisdom of the of the ancients. Well, so people keep doing this, and a surprising number of people in the ancient world and right up into the classic world find that one of the best ways to clean your teeth and to brighten them is to swoosh them around with pee, with urine. And this is common enough and sort of disgusting enough that you have these weird things in classical poetry, like Catullus, this Roman poet, who
was famously racy also.
Racy, right, exactly. And, you know, who is writing this poem making fun of this Spanish guy who's like this flashy Latin lover who's got these gleaming white choppers, and they're like, don't trust those choppers, you know, in the classic nerdy response to this. So he has this poem denouncing him because those choppers come from brushing his teeth with urine. So he says, in the land of Celtiberia, which is Spain, whatever each man has urinated, with this he is accustomed in the morning to rub his teeth and his red gums. So the more polished those teeth of yours are, the more urine they proclaim you to have drunk. So this is clearly a diss.
Right.
So the point here is that people are very, very concerned. I think we should emphasize that if you aren't able to clean your teeth and you have this, you end up with teeth dropping out. And it's not like, you know, a bird molting its feathers.
It's not like losing your baby teeth.
Yeah, no, it's not fun.
Yeah.
And so there you have bleeding, you have pain, and there's a whole raft of medieval treatments all over the world for this universal pain of having infected gums and bleeding and so forth, you know, with various poultices that you would put on. And, you know, there's these special cloths that you bought and wrapped around your head. And this is a sort of a stock figure in like Hogarth illustrations. People with these cloths around their head signifying that they have terrible teeth.
You have this rotting, infected
mass
in your mouth, and it's very painful. And the treatment for that, and this is why you end up with that George Washington with one tooth in his head at inauguration, is that you get your teeth pulled out so that you can, once it heals, your mouth won't be this miserable, painful, infected mess.
Right. And getting your teeth pulled up, remember, we're not talking about, you know, modern dentistry with anesthesia.
Right,
or something.
There's no,
we're talking about a guy with a pair of pliers.
Right.
And
exactly.
He reaches in your mouth and they yank, you know, and they put your head in a clamp and all this.
Right.
It's awful.
Right.
But it's slightly less awful than,
well, it's a short-term pain for a long-term gain.
Right.
So various places in the world, there would be a particular kind of tree, neem tree in India, that would be known as like the tree you would get a stick from, and you would fray one end, you would rub that on your teeth to brush your teeth.
And you can literally buy those still in much of Asia. You can go to the, you know, the little kiosk, and they have these little thin sticks that are kind of pre-mashed.
Right, right. Another thing was in Europe, people would often just drench a cloth in some whatever it was that they believed would be good for their teeth. And probably that's what, you know, Urine Man in Spain was using. And it's for the prevention of, you hope, tooth pain, but it's also maybe about shining your teeth up.
Very much about shining
your teeth.
There's all this attention to this, but people still have really, really bad teeth, and it gets much worse when sugar becomes common as a product of sugar.
So you don't go from carbohydrates or starches to sugar. You go directly to the sugar. Often that sugar is in tea, which also stains your teeth.
Right, exactly. It's a killer, right? And If there's one universal law of human behavior, it's that people like sugar. Michael Pollan wrote this very funny thing about, you know, his kid, he had this, you know, I'm going to keep him from sugar. And then when he's two, somebody gives his kid a cupcake or something. And the kid, holy cow, how have the world exist? And I didn't know this was in it, you know. And I can test from having my own kids that that's pretty much the case. So, you know, it's difficult to get sugar in like Britain, you know, in 1700. But consumption just shoots up anyway. So in 1700, the average Briton eats like 4 pounds of sugar a year. By 1770, it's 16 pounds. At this point, the toothbrush comes in. Now, almost any time you write something about the history or talk about the history of technology, there's this thing, the Chinese invented it first.
Right. Everything's about eyeglasses.
Yeah. The story is that the Chinese invented it first, the toothbrush, in 1498. But I am kind of suspicious of this sort of stuff. I finally tracked down the original source. There's a Chinese encyclopedia from 1609 called the Sanka Tui. I butchered the pronunciation, but you can figure it out. It's 106 volumes. Some kind Japanese person has digitized the entire thing. I found the toothbrush phrase. And it's this ridiculous story that says the emperor invented the toothbrush on a particular day in September in 1498. Yeah, right.
And when was this encyclopedia put
1609.
Yeah. But sometime between 1498 and 1609, the toothbrush became a thing in China.
Yeah, but it was, and then they show a picture of it. And it's really just, it's basically like a hairbrush that you put on your mouth. It's like not an actual toothbrush.
So maybe he invented a toothbrush, or maybe he invented a slightly smaller
hairbrush.
Appliance for your hair.
Yeah, yeah.
Product on your hair.
That people mash on their teeth. So maybe. But anyway, so what we do know is that there is a guy named William Addis, who's a rag trader, meaning that he, you know, collected people's rags and they're cut up to make, you know, paper and stuff. And he was 46 years old and he gets arrested for rioting, which in England, you know, in the 1770s is actually a crime that covers a whole lot of stuff from, you know, actively trying to kill the king to getting drunk in public or being annoying. So he's sentenced to Newgate Prison. And what he decides to do with his time in Newgate Prison is invent the toothbrush. Supposedly, he's inspired by seeing the brushes they sweep the awful stuff off the floors with, but he takes a chicken bone and he whittles it. And the implication is that they give prisoners knives.
Well, I think the prisoners probably bring their own knives. It's a different kind of prison from what we're used to.
Right. Maybe they use them to dispose of each other.
Right.
And he whittles this into shape and he puts little holes in it. And then, because it's a different kind of prison, there are apparently rats and cats and dogs just running around this prison. And he plucks the hairs from them and he ties it and he makes this thing and he starts brushing his teeth.
Probably the whiskers, maybe some
whiskers,
of the things.
Yeah, it's not clear.
It's not clear. Why. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
You know, you need a slightly stronger hair.
Right,
than
right. Some sort of rat hair. Maybe rat hair is stronger than I think it is.
So ick, but he invented
in prison. In 1780. He markets it. It's the first.
So he gets out of prison and becomes a toothbrush
king. Yeah, toothbrush king. And in fact, the company is still around. It's called the Wisdom Toothbrush. And you can, you know, get them mostly in Britain. It still exists. And the company, Addis's family, owned it until 1996. So from 1780 to 1996, there's this company making toothbrushes that were descended from the original chicken bone and rat toothbrush, which is kind of amazing. Now, they don't really have toothpaste. And so they're using these weird mixtures that mostly date back to the Egyptians. Like, you know, you mash up cattle hooves and eggshells and pumice and things like that. They're not really that effective. But in 1873, the first commercial toothpaste, it's in a jar, comes out. And it's Colgate. It's literally the same thing today is Colgate. There's something about this market that caused the incredibly long-lasting
companies.
Yes.
And you look for toothpaste jars, you can find toothpaste jars.
Like vintage ones or still ones made today?
Vintage ones. And also toothpaste tubes, some of which still have toothpaste in them.
Wow. And you, of course, there are collectors.
Yes, yeah. Of course.
Yeah, because that is the way the modern world works. Anyway, there's this relatively slow adoption, so much that, you know, when you have World War II, the United States standard for what makes an acceptable soldier, you know, the physical standard, includes something that just seems crazy today. they have to have a minimum of 3 teeth on the top and 3 teeth on the bottom that meet so that you can chew food between them. And the incredible thing is thousands of 18-year-olds fail this test. There are thousands of 18-year-olds that don't have 3 teeth on one side and 3 teeth on the, you know, the other side,
right,
that can, which is mind-boggling. So the Army actually caves in because they're rejecting.
After Pearl Harbor.
Right,
so this is, the rejection rate is too high.
For dental reasons. And so they then begin the world's largest dental program, and they end up, by the end of this, by giving soldiers, I mean, again, these are 18-year-olds, 1.4 million sets of dentures and filling 31 million cavities.
And this explains something from my childhood, which was, I remember we had this somewhat elderly babysitter who used to like to watch Lawrence Welk, which was this show for
elderly babysitters
with old people in the 60s and maybe into the 70s. And they had a lot of ads for Polygrip,
right,
which was for dentures. So if you think the people who were old in the 60s and 70s were the pre-World War II generation.
Right.
Like the parents of the people who fought in World War II, maybe.
Right. So, but after this, there's this radical change. And part of that is toothbrushes, which they've improved slowly over this time, and they are now made with boar bristles and things like that. But they're still not great.
Yes.
A miracle material comes in.
Miracle material. Here we are. This is my thing, because I wrote The Fabric of Civilization. The first synthetic fiber is nylon. And the story of nylon is a really interesting story and in some ways kind of tragic. But there's a guy, brilliant chemist named Wallace Carruthers, and he's at Harvard. DuPont, the chemical company, comes to him and says, we want to start a research lab, and we've heard you're the guy to found it. And this is in the 1920s. And he first says, no, because I have some psychological issues. I'm better suited. He actually says, I'm better suited to the university life. And they're really persistent. And they say, you can do whatever you want.
Really?
You know, this is and sort of scientist's dream. And you'll also make more money than you're making at Harvard. And he's less motivated by the money, but that you can do whatever you want, that appeals to him because he's come up with a scientific question that he wants to research. And that question is, there are these substances found in nature, like starches and proteins. They have these ridiculously large atomic weights, the molecules. And
the molecules have a billion atoms.
They're like way too big.
Right.
Doesn't make any sense. And the dominant theory is we just haven't figured out these are really compounds of multiple molecules.
All mashed together.
That we just haven't figured out how to separate. And by far, that's what most chemists believe. But there is a minority view that no, it really is one humongous molecule. Carruthers is interested in this theory and is trying to prove the theory that, yes, it really is one humongous molecule. So he goes to DuPont with that research in mind, and he pursues that research, which leads to discovering polymers, which are these long chains. They are humongous molecules that do these super long chains.
And the length is really extraordinary. Latex is one. And a polymer scientist told me that the way to envision what latex is like is something the size of a pencil that's a quarter mile long.
So
an insanely long chain.
Right. So when I use the scientific term humongous, I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
They're really super long, found in nature, latex that's natural rubber, starches, proteins. In the process of establishing the scientific fact that polymers are these long chains, Carruthers and his other people in his lab develop what is the first polyester. It's not the polyester we know today as a garment, breaks down too much to be like of any use commercially, but poly means many, and ester is a particular shape. And so the molecule is called polyester. This is like in 1931, he publishes the authoritative scientific article about polymerization. Fast forward to 1934, and his boss comes to him and he says, Wallace, you remember that thing I told you about you can do whatever you want? It's the Depression. We need some stuff we can make money on. We can't afford you can do whatever you want. Can you come up with something that maybe could be a fiber that we could market in competition with wool and et cetera? And he says, you know, wool is a polyamide, they've now discovered. This is a poly, again, it's a polymer, and amide is another particular configuration of atoms. And so Carruthers says, okay, I'll do this. And he does this research, and this produces nylon. And nylon is this very exciting, marketable fiber. Unlike the initial thing, it's not just good in the lab. They can immediately see this could revolutionize women's stockings. And boy, that's a huge market. But the first actual application, the first commercial product with nylon is the toothbrush. It is something that is called Dr. West's Miracle Tuft toothbrush that promises in its initial ads that it will end your bristle problems.
So the bristle problem is that the hairs come off in your mouth. And I've actually used this because while we lived in Japan and we had a nutty neighbor who insisted that these were better. And I got a, you can still buy
boar bristle tooth.
And I did it. All these hairs.
Yeah. And the other thing about nylon and a lot of polymers is that it repels water.
Right.
So the boar bristles and often the handles, they might be bone or ivory or even silver, but often they might be wood and that absorbs water as well. So the invention of nylon and plastic handles and all of that, it kind of revolutionizes the toothbrush.
Because the toothbrush becomes kind of a yucky object when it's repeatedly absorbed all the residues and everything
and
in it. Yeah.
And so the stockings, they debut at the 1939 World's Fair, and everybody wants nylon stockings. But because of the war, all the nylon production gets used for things like parachutes and tow ropes and military applications.
So do they have commercial toothbrushes then, or is that after the Second World
War? No, it's before. It's actually before. And in fact, I believe, although I'm not sure, in the war, if you're in the Army, they give you a toothbrush and they make you brush your teeth twice a day. So this mass mobilization of GIs leads to all these people who learn to brush their teeth twice a day. And I think those are, they use nylon brush. And another thing is the price of toothbrushes goes dramatically down. And part of this is, not part of it, all of it is pretty much because of plastic.
You're right.
So toothbrushes also get cheaper and cheaper at the same time that people are getting richer and richer.
Basically, an unquestionably good thing, because when you look at the people who are just a little bit older than those GIs, there's a study in 1958 that 60% of the people in the U.S. were over the age of 65. So 1958, that meant they weren't in the war, had no teeth, not a single one. I mean, George Washington at least had one.
Hence Lawrence Welk.
Right. So things are really actually pretty dire. And there's these steps that happen, like Crest happens with fluoride toothpaste, which is introduced in 1965. Procter & Gamble wants to do something about Colgate's lock on the market. And so what they do is create this toothpaste that has fluoride in it. And they get the American Dental Association to do a whole bunch of tests on it to show that it is effective. They get the seal of the American, and they ride that seal
absolutely. When I was a kid, we always had Crest. And interestingly, my grandparents used Pepsodent, which was heavily advertised in the 20s, pre-fluoride.
Right.
But we always used Crest because it was endorsed by the American Dental Association for being good for your teeth.
And it was part of this, there was public health campaigns. So when you and I were in elementary school, we would have these tablets. They did this in the school, and all of us kids would eat these tablets, and supposedly the areas of your mouth that needed brushing would
turn red.
And you know,
and then they would give you a toothbrush and a tiny little tube of Crest.
Yeah,
and everybody would go brush. Yes, and it was always Crest.
Yeah.
And you would go brush your teeth to get rid of the
red. They did it in my school. I didn't realize this till years later. after lunch.
Yeah.
So my mouth was a horror. You know, everything was red. It was like, oh my God, that's awful. And it was extremely effective. I religiously began brushing my teeth until, as I said, when I just suddenly decided that this was stupid and it was boring and I wasn't going to do it. I got a whole bunch of cavities.
So speaking of all these cavities,
yes,
I also have a lot of cavities from my childhood, seven.
Yeah.
But I blame them on the fact that my town did not have fluoridated water.
So this is the other wing of, while the toothpaste is happening, fluoride is also being used. And this is one of those things that goes back much further than you expect to a Colorado dentist named Frederick McKay. Now, there are parts of the United States, parts of Colorado being one of them and Missouri being another, where there's a lot of fluorine in the water, just naturally. Right. He discovered two things. First, that the fluorine discolored people's teeth. There is, things that are called like Colorado mouth, and you would have these dark, unsightly stains. And people were starting to be concerned about, you know, the look of their mouth. They want to be able to smile and not have people draw back in horror.
Have they tried urine?
Right. And they don't know about urine because Colorado, the great urine shortage in Colorado. So what they do is he begins investigating this. And then he discovers that people with those stains have many fewer cavities. And there becomes this idea that fluorine causes teeth to be bad in one way and good in the other. At that time, there is a number of industries that are just releasing fluorine into the water as a byproduct of manufacturing, and they begin to get worried that they're going to get sued. One of these during the 1940s is the Manhattan Project. And
the Manhattan Project is worried about being sued?
Well, they're worried that people are going to blame them for wrecking people's teeth. Okay. and so forth. And so much money and so much personnel is being thrown at the Manhattan Project that it has time and budget for ancillary projects like surveying its employees' teeth.
Okay.
And surveying the downstream people's teeth. They all discover that fluorine in the small doses can help with cavities. And there's a number of studies that begin in 1945 where they, you know, compare towns like yours to towns that, you know, introduce, and they all show that fluorine prevents cavities. And there's this massive program that begins in the 1950s to have fluoridation, you know, in every town that you possibly can.
It's very controversial, right, in some quarters.
There's three reasons, I guess, because there's always nuts, right?
Yeah.
Who just think anything you do is crazy. And some of the, you know, are those, you know, are you playing God with our teeth? But the two sort of driving factors are people who say fluoride, which is the actual compound that is close to fluorine, which it is, and fluorine is a deadly chemical. What on earth are we doing putting a toxin in our water?
But chlorine is deadly, but we eat sodium chloride all the time,
right.
Called
now,
salt.
I am not, yeah. So people's ability and knowledge of chemistry isn't what it might be.
Right.
And the second thing is, the government is putting stuff in our water.
Water, right.
And
yeah.
Water is a symbol of purity and so forth. And what are they doing? Why are they doing this? And there's part of it is this sort of, you know, removing individual choice, and part of it is conspiratorial. And there's lots and lots of protests, and people testify to Congress that this is a communist plot to turn us into moronic, unthinking slaves.
Which I'm pretty sure, I do not know this for a fact, but I'm pretty sure it was that concept that was why Greenville, South Carolina, which was also and still is to this day proud of how delicious its water is,
yes,
did not have fluoridated water.
In fact, most of the United States isn't like Greenville. We all, as a result, have much, much better teeth than was, you know, the ordinary person today, because of the Crest toothpaste, because of the awareness programs, because of things like fluoridation, has fantastically better teeth than even the richest person 200 years ago.
When
the
my
infections,
mother was a kid, when she got her fillings, and this is like in the 40s, they didn't use anesthetic. Like, it was like Marathon Man.
Oh, my God.
Were
they drilling?
They were drilling, yeah. I remember in the late 80s, early 90s, there was this kind of crisis in the dental profession. People's teeth had gotten so good, they weren't having enough cavities And filling cavities was the bread and butter of dentistry.
They're that like
was
the Maytag repairman, right? In those commercials, right? Yeah.
So people would be encouraged to go to the dentist every 6 months and have their teeth cleaned and all of that. But that wasn't enough to keep practice thriving.
Right.
Dentists wanted people not to have cavities,
right.
But the business model had been based on the assumption that a certain amount of your revenue would come from filling cavities.
There'd be kids like me.
Yeah, and it started to be a problem. What basically saved dentistry was cosmetic dentistry. So if you go to the dentist, and there'll also be ads of various kinds in the dentist's office for teeth whitening or various kinds of things. So people started paying to get better looking teeth. Now that their teeth weren't falling out and they didn't even have that many cavities, people started paying for cosmetic dentistry, and that became a significant part of dental practice.
Yes, so my dentist has also told me that a big help was the fact that people started living longer. And even though we have much better dental health, by the time you're 80, you're still likely to have problems.
Right.
And she said, yeah, I'm in the geriatric business.
That's very interesting. So you live long enough to develop the problems that people used to develop in their youth.
Yeah.
And so the dentist can treat the old folks.
Right, right.
When you go to the dentist today, the dentist does not ask, do you brush your teeth? Because the assumption is everyone brushes their teeth. They might ask you, how often do you brush your teeth? Most likely, they will not ask about toothbrushing at all.
Right.
But they will ask, do you floss?
Right.
And I'm happy to say that I get very good reviews from the dentist because I floss regularly once a day. And this is actually because of a kind of textile innovations, kind of, which is dental floss. It used to be sort of waxed cotton thread, not pleasant to use. And when I was a kid, I don't know, I think it goes back into the 19th century, the idea of, you know, cleaning between your teeth with this waxed cotton thread. And then some time in my adult life, a miracle occurred.
A genius.
They took Gore-Tex, which was this way of coating fabric that made it originally better for outdoor activities, more waterproof and different things like that. They used it to make dental floss, which didn't break and was smooth and easy to use.
And they clearly regard that the battle for brushing your teeth has been won, but the battle for flossing your teeth is ongoing, and, you know,
so
very slow progress.
And then the other thing they often want you to do is use a water pick, which is taking flossing to the next level. A water pick is a brand, but there are competing brands. But use a little thing that jets water in between your teeth to really, really get them clean, which I confess I do not do, although my husband does.
And the really fascinating point about this is that there's all this technology possibly coming online, you know, ranging from things that are sonic, science fiction stuff about breeding friendly bacteria that go into your mouth. But the commonality in all of this is that dental health, that, you know, this thing that we have compared to ours and could, but still could be much better, ever less relying on just simple brushing and more on all these other kinds of things. So I have an excellent dentist who's sort of an old line dentist and is nerdy enough, will come up to me and say, I just read the most amazing article in the Journal of the American Dental Association, and I made a copy for you. And so that, you know,
can't
I live
say
in a university.
I've ever had a dentist do refer to an article.
So, you know, I live in a university town. Maybe that's the reason. Anyway, there's this couple, actually, Barbara and Jim, and they're fantastic, but they're extremely data oriented, which I like. I'm like their perfect client. Oh wow, yeah, I'll take that article. You know, she always says a couple of things that illustrate what you're. One is she's quite brutally honest about what's happening here, and she'll say, "Look, most people's teeth fall out because diet. You can't overcome it." But because you take excellent care, you are very likely to have most of your teeth when you're dead. And she said, and this is a huge change. When she started out, they would get 70-year-olds with you know, very, very few right. teeth. And this is this remarkable change. One of the things she takes pride in is that it doesn't hurt.
Yeah,
and,
right,
you know,
right.
she's very careful about right. the Novocaine. And,
right, and
so
nowadays, you know, thinner needles and,
yeah it's really, but, wow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I've had a couple of root canals and they're, you know, root canals famously super painful.
Yeah.
It's nothing.
And the same thing
know.
For me with wisdom teeth. Right. And, you know, it was miserable. It wasn't something that was the everyday lot
yes,
of
right.
people throughout time. And there's a funny line, I think it may be from Stuart Brand. If you don't believe in progress, just go to a dentist.
Thank you for joining us for Everyday Abundance. This podcast is sponsored by the Abundance Institute, and you can find all the episodes and show notes on their website at abundance.institute. Very easy to remember. Also easy to remember is our YouTube channel, Everyday-Abundance. Please subscribe. You can also find episodes wherever you get podcasts. Our producer is Toby Murashanu, and the music was written and performed by John Harden.
If you like this and want to support us, the most important thing you can do is actually leave a review. And this matters in ways that the gods of the algorithm are best able to explain.